This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, and thank you for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. This is part two of an adventure I had a few years ago when I spent some time on Svalu, the biggest private game reserve in South Africa. I'd gone there to cover an unusual story. Andy Malcolm, who's a gamekeeper from Invermark Estate in the Angus Glens, was swapping jobs with Svalu's assistant manager, Dylan Smith. Now, it was fascinating stuff and great fun to do, but as you know, recently we've been looking at Scottish sporting estates, what they do, how they function, the impact they have on the countryside. And it occurred to me that what I'd seen in Africa could throw up some very interesting comparisons. The aim on Svalu is, and I'm quoting here, to restore the Kalahari to itself, herbivores eating grass and predators eating herbivores. One of the most beautiful and elegant of all those predators is the cheetah. Gus van Dijk is the reserve's general manager.
Okay, we're just putting the finishing touches to a radio collar. We're releasing two male cheetahs in the next 2 days. So what we want to do is fit him with a radio transmitting collar that sends out a signal 24 hours a day. It's a VHF collar, so it's just a little transmitter. And we can use a directional antenna to find them again. What we want to know is, once we've released them, have they settled down? Are they leaving the protection of the Svalu area, in which case we need to perhaps go and fetch them? And over the next few months, have they settled down in a measured territory? So without a radio collar, we'd have a hard time doing that.
You know how many cheetah you have on the estate?
We know how many we've released, but we don't know how many we have, because particularly the northern boundary is pretty porous. Animals move in and out all the time. We're not far from the southern areas of Botswana, which is a very large tract of uninhabited land. So cheetahs and leopards and brown hyenas do move in and out of there. But those are typically incredibly shy. So if we see a really shy cheetah, we're fairly confident that it's a nomadic cheetah, for want of a better term. But then every now and then we get hold of a cheetah that gets confiscated by the conservation authorities, perhaps someone trying to smuggle with it. We've had that before. Or an animal that's caught in a trap somewhere illegally. And then we take on those animals, hold them for a while in a holding facility, and then we release them when we feel they've relaxed enough, calmed down. And once we're released, we think, yeah, we can find them and follow them.
Yeah. The whole conservation philosophy behind this place is to try and get as close to nature as possible. I mean, surely if you're following that to its logical conclusion, one of these days you're going to walk out the gate, lock it behind you, and leave them to it.
Even at 1,000 square kilometres, we're probably naive to think we could just leave it to itself. But what we're trying to do is not take it back 200 or 300 or any measured term. What we're trying to do is make sure that the ecosystem has all its components to function naturally. So the ecosystem function that gave rise to the Kalahari should continue to exist, that animals should continue to live and die with drought and be hunted by lions and, you know, battle through it and survive in a very hostile system. Once all those ecosystems are there, it is largely self-maintaining.
So yeah, standing up at the back of a pickup truck, leaning on the roof, is a great way to see Africa like this.
Particularly this time of day.
Yeah.
Just got this warm, sunny day. Yeah.
Right, guys, what we need you to do is just stay sitting down in the vehicle. What we're going to do is we're just going to drive up to the boma, reverse in. I'm going to offload the carcass. The cheetah will come to the gate. This is a theory. Charlotte's going to be able to put a dart into it. Very simple, very plain, but obviously we want as little noise as possible, as little movement on the back as possible. They are very relaxed cats, so I don't foresee any problems. But obviously if we can eliminate any other factors, it'll be easier.
Yeah, we're just going to go up right now and hopefully dart a cheetah. As with so many of these things, your first chance is your best chance. So we're trying to keep things just as normal as possible. It's not going to want to see a heap of people here, so most of us are going to try and keep out of sight and keep very, very quiet.
Okay.
And this is the boma coming up right now.
two of them.
Beautiful animals.
Come, boys.
And Dylan's just pulling the shot warthog into the first open area.
The one on the left is show.
And Charlotte, the vet, has got the rifle tucked behind her back.
This one is the show.
Just going to dart in one of them.
Yeah, let's just go. I just pulled this beast out.
You want that eye cover?
It's astonishingly large.
Have I feel it, Dean? Look at the claws here quickly. There you go.
Here's the dew claw. Wow. That's the one that does like the damage as a cheetah, right?
Okay.
So you can see that under track. So these are like running spikes, that's fine.
Yeah.
And all fixed, but that one's quite sharp by comparison.
Yeah.
And then just look at the tail.
That tail's amazing.
It's like a hockey stick more than a
round.
It's
just basically that's a rudder for running, isn't it?
And look how skinny it is, look how narrow it is. Put your hand across like that.
It's just a classic sprinter.
Chill, Dylan. Well, I don't have chill, Dylan, either.
Okay, Dylan, I think turn him over properly, then I don't want to bend him.
Okay.
So Cassidy is measuring up the collar against the cheetah's neck.
The fencing closet.
But this thing's about the size of a human sprinter. I didn't think they were as big as this.
Box of drawer,
let's watch this now.
That's open. Are you sure? Cassidy's
on. Okay, the danger with fitting a collar, particularly to a cheetah, is they can, if you don't fit it nice and snug under the jaw, it pushes down their neck, which is really relatively long and evenly sized, and they can get their bottom jaw into and behind the collar. Then they pick their head up in fright and they hook the jaw into their collar, and then they can't get it out. Mm-hmm. And that's why we like to do this a few days before we release them. Just make sure he's comfortable with the collar. It's like wearing a wristwatch, really. It's a fraction of his body weight, but we want to give him a few days to get used to it. And if he does get it into his mouth, we've got plenty of time to take it out again. It's a very rare occurrence, but if he's running out in the wild and you can't catch him, you don't. It's the worst scenario.
Yeah.
23
You don't hear that very often. It's the sound of a snoring cheetah.
Why, what's the question?
I had wondered how you were going to attach this, and it's basically just bolted on.
Yeah.
Strongest possible way of doing it.
Very much so. Yeah, we occasionally will use rivets, but the beauty of this system is it allows us to change our mind if we see it's a little bit tight or a little bit loose, or especially if it's a growing animal, you can dart it again and just move it up a notch or two and refit it. Whereas if it's with rivets, then you have to remake the collar.
Ready?
You know what strikes me with this, Dylan? Even the crew want the photographs taken with this thing.
Well, it's not every day that people get to work with cheetah and that. You know, all the plains game is fairly common, but dealing with predators and that is not nearly as frequently encountered as the plains game. So it's always something exciting. And I think people always have this fascination with predators.
These two males in this holding camp here have attracted some wild cheetah. We don't know who it is. It's come up, had a look, sees that there's free lunch here maybe, or maybe it's a female that's looking for a mate. Quite interesting. It's just lovely that these animals do turn up from time to time.
And the one that was darted and is now recovering isn't even bothered sitting up to eat.
Yeah, he's nicely a bit stoned, but he's got the munchies now.
But if both of these are being released early next week, you're going to have to do exactly the same thing for the second one tomorrow.
Oh, no, we just want one collar on.
You just want one collar on?
Yeah, okay. They are coalition. That coalition will last for life.
Two male?
Yeah. Male cheetahs form coalitions of two or three. And that, as I said, does last for life normally. If they separate, it would be an extraordinary circumstance that does it. And, as two males, they're more successful as one. So they can get more access to females. They can defend a territory. They might be more successful at catching bigger prey. That, I suppose, is somewhat debatable. But as coalitions, they definitely are more successful. So those two boys have grown up their whole life together. They'll walk out together and they'll always be together. You'll normally have one of them that dominates over the other. But we only need one collar on, because if one collar's there, we know the other animal will be close by.
A couple of days after that collar was fitted to the cheetah, The plan was to release it and its pal into the wild. Now, you'd think it would just be a case of opening the gate, but it's not as simple as that. First, we had to get hold of something to lure them out of the enclosure. Gamekeeper Andy Malcolm had done the needful.
Okay, what we've got here is a warthog. We've had to acquire a warthog because this afternoon we're releasing a couple of cheetah from a boma. And what happens is these cheetah that have been in the boma, they've been kept in by an electric fence. And they can be very, very reluctant to go out through a gate if they've had a jolt from the fence any time in the past. So what we've done is we've shot a warthog to use as bait to draw the cheetah out. But furthermore, once they're out, it'll give them a final feed before they're off and they're fending for themselves. So we've gone out and we've shot a warthog. I have to say it's the only shooting that happens on this place just to feed predators out in Boma. I want to stress that. And what we've got here is a particularly old boar. We've been having a look over him and you can see he's pretty well scarred. He's got a damaged eye. His teeth are down to the gums and frankly I think his days were numbered anyway.
Not the bonniest creature on God's earth. I mean, we've seen these things wandering about the garden here. What surprises me about him is how dense it actually... I mean, it's a remarkably heavy-looking animal.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this thing here, I mean, it's quite compact compared with having a red deer hind lying stretched out at your feet. But it's as wide as it is deep, incredibly dense, and believe it or not, it weighs about the same as a full-grown red deer hind.
Got these tusks at the front, but I mean, the really scary stuff, just pulling the gums back at the front, are those incisors. You know, he's got two incredibly sharp teeth coming up at the front.
Yeah, that's right, and often when you hear of people falling foul of a warthog, it's these really sharp teeth that come from the lower jaw. Yeah, even touching them with your thumb, you can just feel how sharp they are. I find it absolutely fascinating to be able to handle these things up close. It's the same when we do the live game capture. It's phenomenally interesting to see them, to be able to touch them and smell them. The problem is often with the live capture, you don't have much time to go over them. You know, when you have something like this stretched out of your feet, you know, you can sort of just go over it and you can appreciate how they're built, why they're built like this. You can actually sort of see a bit of their history. I'm looking at the ear of this one here. You can see it's all ragged. You know, this is an old veteran, and you know, I imagine he's been in a good few tussles in his ears. You know, going by all these scars, you know, he's obviously been sort of looking after a territory.
Oh, well, he's got a use. Off to the cheetah. Take that one.
Hey,
there we go.
The pig. Big.
Svalo is located in the North Cape of South Africa, just on the fringes of the Kalahari. As Gus explained, it is unbelievably rich in all sorts of wildlife.
Well, first and foremost, this area is dry. It's dry savanna. So the species that live here are animals that can cope with drought. In fact, many of the species that are most successful in the Kalahari are species that do live underground. So you might see a whole host of different rodents, spring hares, there's rock rabbits in the hills, there's scrub hares and cape hares on the flats, hedgehogs, and then right through little carnivores, which you see in few places else on Earth. Things like cape foxes and art wolf and small spotted cat, African wildcat. Really a fascinating diversity of small carnivores, right up to the big carnivores, which I'm personally am very fond of, the hyenas, two species of hyenas, cheetahs, leopards, lions, you know, the things that you really would expect in Africa. Then apart from the carnivores, then all the other interesting creatures that move around at night a lot, polecats and things, pangolins, art wolf, things that live, art vark, animals that live on termites and ants. And then a whole range of antelope species, from very small steenbok and duiker right up to giraffe and eland, perhaps the most typical of the Kalahari's, the gemsbok or the oryx, an animal that is just superbly adapted to these very dry environments.
I was bowled over by the sheer variety of creatures I saw at Svalu, but when I compared it to what we have at home, and everyone thinks how great Scotland is for wildlife, we're actually remarkably poor in comparison. A point I put to the owner of Svalu, Nicky Oppenheimer.
But that's true of everything. I mean, if you look at the flora in South Africa, the huge diversity of flora there compared with Europe, and of course the animals, the birds, the insects, that's absolutely true. But in both places, what you're doing is, in your way, looking to preserve wilderness and making a contribution to do that. Mm-hmm. And successfully so, too, because it's gone on for a number of years.
See, interesting that you should say that Invermark is a wilderness. I flew over it. It is tens of thousands of acres, to my mind, of managed moorland. You can see the hand of man all over that. There's lots of muir burn and things, and it's being managed for very few species. That's not what happens in Svalu.
Well, that may be true, but it is wilderness. It's the end of the road. I like places which are
the end of the road. All right. Yeah.
And you get up in the hills there, and you don't see a house and you don't see a fence. You will see burns, and you do know, I mean, that Andy and his fellow keepers are working flat out every day to preserve particularly grouse and red deer. And you can say that's not a huge diversity. And maybe that is a contrast with Africa, but it is looking after it and it is preserving it from generation to generation.
You say the word Svalu means new beginning or rebirth. What is the sort of philosophy behind that reserve? What is it you're trying to achieve?
Well, it obviously not my creation. I mean, a strange Englishman, Stephen Bowler, put the thing together, and I've always had huge admiration for him, because I'm quite certain that if he'd come to me and said, come and be my partner, let's go and buy 35 farms, 100,000 hectares in total in the Kalahari, we'll knock all the farms down, take all the fences out, I wouldn't have given him the time of day. But he clearly had a vision and a determination. I think he was probably pretty impossible, but people with vision generally are. And so I have huge admiration for what he's done. And what we've tried to do is build on his platform, and that is you have a huge swathe of the Northern Cape in the Kalahari. It has a fence around it, so it has to be managed. But you are trying to turn it, as we say down at Svalu, restoring the Kalahari to itself.
As it turns out, restoring the Kalahari to itself can be a messy business.
Just explain what you're doing.
Cutting a pig in half.
No, it's a living.
It's a living. It's a harsh living, but it's a living nonetheless.
Right, we've got a half pig. What are we doing with it, Gus?
Taken into the cheetah boma, the cheetah that we fitted the collar on the other day, and Andy's going to drag the carcass out the gate, and hopefully the cheetah males follow, and hopefully they get attracted to the warthog more than they get attracted to Andy. And that's it. Once out the gate, we close the gate behind them, and they're released. Once they're released, they're on their own. You know, we've had them there for a while, just getting them accustomed to electric fencing and to people. And I'm looking forward to having them released.
How long's my bit of rope going to be?
I'm going to give you about 6 feet.
It's his last day here. It's, you know.
Yeah, he's starting to sound like he's getting
scared
of cheetah now.
He goes.
Yeah, exactly.
He's had a good life.
He's served his purpose. Yeah.
Let me show you what we're going to do for you.
That goes across his snout. Other side, the tusks and that's it.
All right.
Walkies.
Okay.
Walking
are you ready when you are? Let's go.
Sting the pink cord.
I was involved with a cheetah release once before, when I was here last time. But the cheetah in the boma, the last time, were really super cool. Didn't seem to be fazed at all by people. And when we went down just a couple of days ago to put the radio collar on one of these cheetah, I have to say I was really surprised at how much snarling and spitting there was when the vet went down the side of the fence with the dart gun. But before she'd fired a shot, these cats really weren't happy with their presence.
and that makes me nervous.
This is us just turning off the road now towards the Cheetah Boma. There's several sightseers.
Yeah, yeah. I hope there's not going to be too much of a spectacle for them.
As you prance about, dragging half a pig behind you.
If I'm prancing about, I'll be delighted. It's if I'm lying motionless on the ground, that's my worry.
Yep. It is just the most fantastic terrain, this, though. You know, the Kalahari is not what I expected. It's much more verdant. We're seeing it at its absolute best because it's been so rainy this season. Low bushes, acacia thorns. Very often you get these little weaver's nests hanging off them. Sometimes the weaver's nests are enormous, big enough to actually break branches off. And the terrain is what I describe as dune streets. It's just rolling terrain, goes backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, almost like corrugated iron. Except the gap between the corrugations is, I don't know, anything up to about half a mile. And between peak and trough is less than 100 feet. And overall, you've got this absolutely enormous blue sky. Well, it's just powder puff clouds. How's the geography of this going to work, Gus?
Well, if these cheetahs are hungry enough, they, hopefully they are, they're going to see the carcass that Andy drags in. They'll certainly see Andy. And he'll drag it out just a couple of meters past the gate. The cheetahs should follow it out and start feeding on the carcass, which Andy's going to tie to a tree just outside the gate here. And as soon as they anchored on that carcass, we'll sneak up behind and just close this gate. Once we've closed this gate behind them, they're pretty much on their own. That's their last free lunch.
It's just Hammer House of Horror.
Should we peg that gate back, John? Oh, it's all right. No, I thought it was going to swing close.
How far in do you want me to take it?
Quite far.
So the gate's wide open now. Andy is pulling
the
considerable half of the pig into the boma.
No. Much further in, Andy.
Joking aside, is there an element of risk here?
Oh, you absolutely have to realise that any time you're working with a wild animal, there's a risk, and you'll hear that all the time, but it's absolutely true. There's a small chance of risk here, but cheetahs, they really are very gentle and more respectful, let's say, towards people. They give people lots of room. They don't have the confidence like a leopard or a lion does to intimidate people. But I think the fact that Andy's got a carcass that he's dragging, their attention will be on the carcass, not on him. I don't think there's a real danger here. You can see these cheetahs are actually really quite shy of Andy. Things are a little bit different to normal. So yeah, they're just keeping an eyeball on him.
How heavy would that considerable half of pig be?
Guessing probably about 45 kilograms, thereabouts, maybe going on, maybe 50.
Looks heavy.
So that's about the weight of a cheetah, one of those cheetahs.
I think just tie it off and then we can maybe just cruise around, Dylan, and
I think so, yeah.
Go around the outside. Yeah, just tie it off there, Andy, and we'll to that bush over there and then leaving it in the open.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. I tell you what though, it's an uncomfortable feeling when you've got your head in a bush knowing that there could be a cheetah coming up behind you.
That's okay, I'm watching.
That's good.
Just if it goes suddenly quiet behind you, you'll know there's a problem.
Right, well, that's the rope tied off.
Okay.
That just means the cheetah aren't going to drag the bait away because there's folk wanting to get pictures of this. So.
Uh-huh.
I tell you what, that's a damn heavy warthog.
Yeah.
Or half a warthog.
I think if you look carefully at the front end, you were actually using that warthog as a miniature plough.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, the tusk at the front was just busy chewing up all this grass. And
yeah.
Dust and what have you.
Well, I'm glad it wasn't just me.
No, no.
Right, now, I must say I feel quite comfortable out sort of retreating and climbing back up onto the vehicle.
Yeah.
young.
They're not cooperating.
No, they're not looking particularly interested. It might just be the time of day. They're not. It's quite warm. They're just relaxing, aren't you? They're also not particularly hungry. They had some food 2 days ago. So they're not being driven by hunger. And they're interested in this other animal outside. So all things are weighted against them getting up. But we're not in any hurry to see them go out. They can leave this boma at their leisure.
Where is he now?
Close to the gate, very close to the gate. Straight on Andy's scent. Well, maybe probably the pig scent.
He's going to ignore the warthog and come straight for you.
Funny, they smell big.
They're out the gate, they're out the gate, Gus.
Good.
Straight out, brilliant. Together, they're both
there
out.
Yeah.
Great.
On the carcass. Brilliant.
There you go, Andy, mission accomplished.
Excellent.
Well done.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. You can see they were a little bit institutionalised. They're a bit reluctant to leave, but no, it's I can see cheesy grins everywhere I look. It's a great feeling, isn't it?
So the other vehicle is just heading up the side of the track there towards these two cheetah, who are now out of the enclosure for the first time in weeks, and they're feeding on the carcass that Andy tied to the tree. And one of the guys on the truck in front has been detailed just to jump off and close the gate, which, as we've already heard, sounds like something out of Hammer House of Horror. So it won't go unnoticed.
No, let's see what they do, but it's... They might want to go back to the security of the boma without the holding enclosure, but I don't think so. They've got focus on food. But the important thing is that there's two more wild cheetah roaming on Tuvalu. Hopefully they anchor here and settle down. You know, if they really put their minds to it, they could move out and head off into farmland beyond, and be chances very good that they get killed. Or they could head out north and land up in southern Botswana from Tuvalu. But hopefully they'll find a nice open place here where, being 2 miles, they can settle down, establish a territory, and they're here for good.
Gus, the fact that these things have been in effective captivity for a couple of months, when they come back out here and they're free, how long does it take them before the instincts kick in and they actually start chasing down things and killing them again?
As soon as they get hungry, the instincts kick in. They haven't lost any fitness. They haven't been fed excessively, so they're not overweight or anything like that. They've probably got enough spare fat on them to last them 1 or 2 missed catches, but they're instantly ready to kill. They come from wild background. They were caught in the wild. They were translocated. So they've lost none of their skills as cheetahs. It's just a nuisance if those cheetahs find their way back into this cage or this encampment. So we want to get the gate closed at all costs now.
And he's jumped off the back of the pickup truck and he's just chaining the gate shut so they can't get back in again. And the cheetahs have only moved about 30, 40 metres away and they're underneath a bush, just lying down, enjoying the shade again. That's it, job done.
One of the biggest ways South Africa differs from Scotland is that over there, live animals are a tradable commodity. Different species have different monetary values. Of course, to trade an animal, you first have to catch it. And as you've already heard, that's most commonly done by darting. I joined Andy and Dylan as they were getting the gear ready for the next day.
This is a book I came across when I was staying in Dylan's house during the exchange. I picked up to leaf through it and really sort of didn't put it down again for 2 or 3 hours. Its title is The Chemical and Physical Restraint of Wild Animals, and it covers all the procedures you need for darting. That's the bit I was particularly interested in. And I was wowed at how complex the process is.
This covers everything from, you know, sort of the different equipment you can use to sort of your safe approaches to helicopters. And there's also a large reference bit to the different animals and the cocktails of drugs you use for them.
You've got the sort of physical side of the darts here, Dylan.
That's right. Well, we got one kind of dart that we're going to use today. It's called a Daninject. Pretty much standard darts in the veterinary industry. It's a sort of hard plastic darts with a very soft, feathery flat on the back, and just to give them stability. In conjunction with that, we're going to use these needles. They're about 30 millimeters in length by 2 millimeters wide, and they've got a little brass collar. And all that does is, once you've darted the animal, it prevents the dart falling out.
Just in case there's anybody listening to this who thinks that, you know, the darts are smeared with something, these are basically flying hypodermic syringes.
That's exactly what they are. Very, very simple way the darts work. You've got a plunger compartment, and then you've got a pressurizing compartment. Okay, so all you do here is you fill your dart with the whatever drug combination that you're going to use, and then you pressurize the dart once the needle is on. So it's sealed on the front. You pressurize it from the back, and then the darts, they've got a very small, the darts themselves, the needle, they've got a very small gel collar. It's a little plastic collar that covers the opening, what they call the port on the needle. Uh-huh. And once it penetrates the animal, it just pushes that gel collar back, and then obviously the pressure gets released through the needle ports, and the drug gets injected into the animal. Very, very straightforward, simple, and it happens almost instantaneously.
Once you've made up these darts, you have to fire it from something. Which one of you wants to talk through this?
Well, I can describe it to you. This is a Danish-made dart gun. I have to say, as a rifle shooter, it's a pretty sexy-looking bit of kit. Very, very futuristic.
I knew you were going to say that.
What did you? Very futuristic-looking. Because the darts are sort of a wide diameter thing. I mean, it looks a bit like a cannon at the business end. A very thick-looking barrel. But then you've got this anodized, green anodized action and a skeleton stock. Very, very different from a normal centerfire rifle. On top of the rifle sits what we would call a single point sight. It's a bit like a telescopic sight, but instead of a crosshair, you've got a bright dot.
What you'll see, particularly if you're darting from a helicopter, obviously the skill of the pilot is as important, if not more important, than the skill of the person doing the actual darting. Because it's a pilot's responsibility to, in theory, pretty much nullify that airspeed. In other words, you want to get over that rhino moving at the same speed that animal's moving at. So you're just following. So essentially, there's no movement over there. The problem is, as the dart goes off, well, that's where your lag comes in. That's where you say you have a problem with the windage and that. And obviously, these darts are not heavy. They can, the downdraft of the helicopter can affect them, any gusting wind and that. So your ideal darting conditions are nice calm days and large targets like rhino or elephant, things like that. But on small animals like zebra and zebra foals, that is really skilled darting work. And like I say, chopper work, brilliant. Very, very good. So yeah, and you get different kinds of darts. We've got another dart gun here called a new dart rifle. And that is a much heavier darts. They use aluminium darts. We've actually got 10mm darts that are about 30 centimetres in length.
But a foot long.
Yeah. Or yeah, almost a foot long darts. Yeah. And those darts, you know, the problem there is you really need a lot of pressure to get the dart to go where you want it to. So you can't use that on small animals because the dart itself is so heavy that were you to miss the area that you're aiming for and hit a leg or a head or something, you'll actually kill the animal. So you've got to be very darting, you've got to be very, very careful with. The darting that we're going to be doing, and hopefully Andy will get to do some of it this afternoon, very straightforward, very simple, hopefully at a very close range, let's say 30 yards at the most, ideally between 10 and 20 yards, relatively large targets. The animals are very relaxed, so hopefully we'll get it right. Uh-huh. Things happen, eh? You know, these are very light. I mean, as Andy knows, you're looking through a scope, sometimes you don't notice a twig or a branch in the way, or grass. You could get a gust of wind that can make the dart veer off course. The animal's reflexes are incredibly fast, and there's many vets that will tell you, you know, especially if you're darting antelope, especially if you're darting 30 yards or more, which is quite a long way for a dart, the animals actually hear that dart coming, and they actually move out the way before it gets them. So
that's a good excuse. Well, exactly. I'll have to remember
it's
that
amazing
one.
Amazing how the elephant leapt out of the way of their daughter. Phenomenal how fast they can move. But yeah, so there are a couple of factors that come into play in that. But hopefully it'll be a fairly routine darting this afternoon. The challenge, of course, is having to dart eight animals out of one group. It's a group of eight sub-adults, four sub-adult females, four sub-adult males. They're probably going on about 2 years old now.
You haven't told us what sort of animal.
It's lions.
Lions, exactly, yeah. So, and we want to relocate these animals to a game reserve up in Mozambique. That's doing a restocking program up there. So it's a whole interesting exercise and a very worthwhile cause as well. Yeah, we just got to get the animals.
Once you get the animals, what do you do with them? You have to have somewhere safe to put them because they've got a nasty habit of waking up. Here's Gus van Dijk again.
This is a predator holding camp, or what we call here a boma. And this is an enclosure which will hold lions for the period from when they're caught to the period to when they're relocated or translocated to a new property.
Why do you want the lions in here rather than out there?
We want to get the lions off the reserve into here because they're already having an impact on prey populations. It's a young group of animals, so they are the animals most likely to break out. We're trying to preempt their breakout. And also it's a good idea to get them into a holding camp like this so that they can get accustomed to the electric fences. And when they get to their new place, they'll have respect for electric fences and that'll just make their translocation a lot better, their reintroduction into a new reserve a lot easier. Electric fences are used to keep lions away from people and livestock. And they're kind of a double-edged sword, really. They're great at keeping wild animals and domestic stock apart, but they also do stop natural movement. So it's really, you just have to decide if the conflict between man and lion is justifies an electric fence, well, then you use it.
The nickname, the King of the Beasts, is that reflected in their value?
No, not at all. Wild lions, zoo-bred lions or whatever, have really no economic value at all. They're incredibly valuable to an ecosystem. I think we often underestimate how important predators are to ecosystems. But in real terms, or financial value, there's no money in breeding lions, and there's no money in their translocation as such. There are operations where there's lion hunting, and that's a totally different thing altogether. But wild lions that are being translocated from one reserve to another, like cheetahs and wild dogs, they don't really have a value because there's limited areas for them to be reintroduced.
So the plan was that we would go out, find the lions, dart them, put them on the pickup trucks and take them back to the boma. But about an hour before that was due to happen, Dylan Smith told us there'd been a change of plan.
Yeah, there hasn't been a drastic change of plan, Mark. What we're going to do is the scouts have just reported that group of lions that we're after, they'd caught the Gemsbok last night. Now, they've split up again, apparently, and four of them have moved straight past the boma. So we'll try to strike while the iron's hot. If they're close enough by there, we'll try to get them into the boma. You know, if they've moved far enough away or they're really full, we'll probably just leave it anyway. But it's worth having a look at and at least just getting an idea if there's a chance of getting them back up to the boma on a drag. It might be well worth a while.
So the intention was to dart them this afternoon and tranquilize them and move them, but if we can put this half warthog on a rope behind the truck and tow it, they might actually go into the boma of their own accord.
Yeah, well, that's what they're thinking is. Whether we get it right or not is another story, but it'll be great. It'll just take a lot of pressure off the darting operation. You've got a far greater chance of being able to dart four lions in one go than eight lions in one go. So if we can get four in the boma now, it'll be fantastic.
I'm hearing Dylan say that there's four of them at the boma at the moment. You see anything?
No, just now. There's a couple of vehicles just coming into sight, and they must be very close to where the lion are. So I'm just getting ready to step down and cower in the back here. Again, you know, sort of normally I wouldn't feel quite so nervous about approaching lion in a vehicle, but the fact that we've got a dead warthog in the back is going to make this vehicle a lot more attractive.
Oh, look there. My God, there's right in the trees in front of us.
We were about 15 metres away. Yeah, get down, I think. About 15 metres away from those lions before we actually noticed them. And all of a sudden they jumped up from underneath this acacia. It's extraordinary that they've come basically to the perimeter fence. Okay. They've come to the perimeter fence of where they want them to be. There's one actually walking this way. How are you going to do this, Dylan?
I'm just going to drag this pig straight past their noses, and if they do what normal lions do, they should get up and go after it. That's the theory.
How long is... Wouldn't you like to rather have both ropes attached to each other, so at least this thing's dragged it a little bit further away from us?
No, what they're going to... No, they're not going to follow it right behind the car.
Are they not?
They're
going to get up... Are you sure about this?
100%, yeah. Yeah. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go into the boma.
Yeah.
Have you got a knife on you? Yeah. Can I give you a knife? Just, if we get into the boma, you need to, you just... Cut the rope around the warthog's muzzle and that's it.
Charlie, which is what we've called the pig, was actually shot several days ago. And 2 days ago, the cheetah's got his legs. They were all cut off. And what's been left of him has been sitting in the back of this pickup truck for the last 2 days in the African sun. So Charlie's really a bit high.
That's about a 3 foot tow rope, Smith.
Oh, that's perfect, that's perfect. They're not going to come right behind the car. Well, they shouldn't.
Just to make sure they're getting the scent, he's busy puncturing the entrails.
No self-respecting lion was going to need those, but God's punctured.
There you go. Have a go with that. Is it just me, or is your heart going faster?
Yeah, I have to say, it's quite a thought.
In a long line of stupid things I've done. Now, the lion are in front of us there. They're still in the shade of the trees. These are two-year-old animals. And Dylan's just... going to drive us within feet of them with his half a pig and a rope stuck behind it, and you can see them from here watching us from under the trees. They've fed already, so maybe they won't be that interested. I see the lioness sniffing the air. Male lion. These things are huge. Absolutely huge.
Seems not coming on.
Hey?
It's okay. All right. This may be on display mode or something.
The thing is, in African terms, this isn't too excessive.
There's the lioness who's come out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Camera.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the lioness is out. Every game guide I've spoken to has got hair-raising tales of close encounters with lion or buffalo. Or
it's one of the young males just shooting out from the side of the bush.
Yeah, they really are getting quite stirred up.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately.
That's what we want.
Yeah, they're stirred up. I thought they may be moving away, but they've only moved as far as the scent trail.
See if they follow it. I mean, everybody knows what a lion looks like. But these seem more... the manes are more chestnutty, more rufous. And they're bigger. They're bigger than
you
think.
Bigger. They're a lot bigger. It's a real feature of Kalahari lions that a full-grown male has a black mane. And when you see one of them, it is such a magnificent animal. Very impressive. Very scary.
Why we parked over here is not going to interfere with anything going in and out of the gate, but also we can see where the pig is. And the normal thing is, exactly like Andy said, is you tie the bait on, okay? What I'm assuming, and it's maybe a poor assumption, but that she's got adequate cover there. She's not going to grab that and turn around and come out again. If anything, she'll grab it and go into that shady area over there. But she's looking keen.
She's looking keen, yeah.
She's about, I would say, 60 metres away from us. And she's just stopped beside the fence, just following the track that we took. And she's just having a good look about. We'll see. Every so often she turns and looks at us, so.
Have you had any thoughts about where the rest of the prey is?
Yes, that thought crossed my mind about 20 minutes ago. Where we're just sitting in the blood-spattered pickup truck. Well, here we go. Attempt 2 at lion fishing. Driving through the Kalahari veld with half a pig on a rope behind a pickup truck.
Not very far behind a pickup
truck. Not terribly far behind a pickup truck. And we're just coming up to the bush where 4 lions are sitting watching us going, what's your game? These great tawny heads. Bright orange eyes. It's a warm day, they're kind of panting in the heat, and that young male's just spotted that and he's up. Young male has seen the bait and is following it. And effectively we're being chased by one of the males. And Dylan, stay there. Yeah, like we're going to do anything else. Strange, I was going to jump out the back and run about. What were you going to do?
Climb a tree.
This would be a bad place to break your transmission.
Yeah, it'd be a bad place to have anything go wrong.
Yeah. Just sit here for a few hours shouting, help!
Yeah, what was a lazy, relaxed afternoon and suddenly take on a different pace.
I have to
say. Did that feel exciting?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, when you've got something the size of a 2-year-old male lion that suddenly pops up on its feet and starts chasing you 10 metres away. Yeah. I was glad Dylan didn't confuse the accelerator pedal for the brake pedal. Put it that way.
Plan A, which was later dubbed Dope in a Rope, and the pig was not the dope, had failed. Reserve manager Gus moved smoothly onto Plan B.
We're going to try and dart all of them together. If 5 of them are together or 4 of them are together, we're going to fire 4 darts so that they all go down roughly the same time. Rather than dart one load, because the dangerous thing is handling lions that are sleeping when there's other lions awake around them. So that's the plan. It doesn't always work out like that. I'd rather knock them out so that they sleep for 2 hours, which is probably a bit unnecessary, than try and keep them so that they sleep for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're aiming for.
I can't help noticing there's a cast of thousands turned up for this. I take it lions are pretty special.
Yeah, they are, but we need manpower to load the lions as well. So rather than have 3 people battling, we've got lots of people pick up quickly and go, because it's a multiple darting. But yeah, lions do always attract attention.
Andries, onthou vir almal te sê as ons naby kom, hulle moet sit.
All right, we've got our teams together. We've got 4 pickup vehicles that'll be recovering the 4 lions we're anticipating. We've made up the darts. We've got lots of hands. What we're doing is we're rolling out now with 2 observer vehicles, as it were, and 4 recovery vehicles. We'll be darting off this vehicle. Obviously, these lions are far easier approached on a vehicle than on foot. So when you're based on a vehicle, you should be fairly safe. The lions do allow you to get close enough for darting. We're looking at getting to within about 20 meters of them and then popping a dart into either their their rump or their shoulder or their neck, any muscle mass really.
Andy, you're getting to take the shot. You ever fired one of those things before?
To be honest, yes, I have. But I mean, the fact that it's a lion and the fact that there's a great mass of spectators, I mean, it's
put a bit of pressure on
it. It has a certain pressure to the shot.
So there's a cavalcade of vehicles just heading along this brick red dirt track. And we're heading back towards the boma where we were this morning, where hopefully those four lions will still be lying up.
Barry, if you can go past on the road heading to Lakhaba, I want you to keep an eye out for animals that run away in your direction. You got me?
Okay, copy, guys.
I get quite nervous when you get too close.
All the buckies can just hold back a little bit. As they get used to us. Let's pressurize nicely. Okay, good dot, good dot. Don't worry.
Brilliant.
Open up the deck.
That's one animal that's been darted already. It's spooked the other three.
Can you see this one's butt? Okay, not quite. Okay, that's okay. A little bit forward and see if we can get a shot. Okay, take it if you can.
Perfect.
Good dot. Okay, so it's that female and that male are both undarted, huh? Okay. All right, Dylan, how much time have we had?
2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Okay. See how slowly time goes off to dotting, huh?
Indeed.
Okay. That guy is lying down there is the one we want, I think, huh?
Okay.
Barry for Gus.
Yeah, standing by.
Barry, we dotted one in the butt, and I don't see him. I don't think he's far. Have you got a visual of him?
He's at about 3 o'clock to us. He was just sitting behind the basket. He's now down. And I'm sure you can see the other one in the grass.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure we're getting the right animals. Thanks, Barry. What we're going to do now, guys, is we're going to wait for the one that's darted in the neck to show a few more signs. And then we're going to try and go in and dart another. Can you see how he's getting a kind of a teddy bear look in his eyes? Yeah. Eh? His ears are drooping a little bit and he's a little bit spaced out. What's very nice here is that he's in the shade. Yeah. So there's no hot chance of the sun damaging his eyes or anything like that. He's not going to heat up. It's not a very hot day. You see now he's getting a fright. He's like, okay, this is good. This is good for us. Andy, have you got your next dart in? Not yet. Okay.
That's where his mates get interested in that dart. They're going to damage the dart.
That's as good because that makes them all curious.
What happened there was that the lioness had a go at him and he shot out and tried running away and he's no longer got full control of his limbs. So he kind of stumbled away and then stumbled back into the shade again.
Good dart. Okay, so great. It's very good.
Great that the lioness is still hanging about.
Yeah. She's going to go back to them now.
The only one left to dart is the female now, so we're looking good.
What would you do, Gus, if the other half of the pride came in?
Dart them.
As fast as possible.
That's the lioness tag now.
Okay, everybody, Amal, last dart is in. Die laaste pijl is in, ons het al vier, maar hulle vat bietjie lank om af te gaan.
Thank you, guys. My mouth
okay,
is like
I'm going to give her a few minutes, and then I'm going to go and just top up all the
you
others.
You did well.
I'm going to check that he's asleep. I'm going to go and pull the cat's tail there. When we've confirmed that he is asleep, I'm going to just get a few people to come and help us load him onto a stretcher. Okay.
That wasn't a figure of speech that Gus was using. He is actually pulling the lion by its tail.
Don't try this at home.
He's saying, don't try this at home. No intention of. He's now pulling it by its mane round and retrieving the dart.
This is just bizarre.
Yeah. Have you looked behind you lately?
Yep, there's another three.
Dylan, what would this thing weigh?
Oh, he's probably 180.
180 to wear gloves.
We're just rolling the second male onto one of these fabric stretchers, lifting them up onto the back of this pickup truck. As soon as that's organised, they get the third one into another truck, and they won't be put into the boma.
God, still.
You can't come park any boma. Yellow tree, mother. All right.
Just have a look at those claws there.
You're just pressing the pad and pushing this forward.
Doesn't feel good when it's on your back.
Yeah, and these massive meat hooks are coming out of the paw, and I can't imagine what it must be like to be on the receiving end of that.
It's about 2 inches long,
and wickedly hooked. Once those are into you, I don't think there's any getting away.
We're just going to roll it right now.
Just let him go down for a minute. Oh, no, well, that's actually all four. That's fine. That's
true. We're just standing here, and all of a sudden the circus has left town.
Yeah, it's not gone very far though. I can't believe this has all happened just a couple of hundred yards from the boma. It's very handy.
Females under me.
Yeah.
This is coming into the boma, where the lions are going to be kept for the next couple of months. And already there are 3 pickup trucks in here, loaded up with lions. The lion is just coming off the back, and her mouth is open, and the canines of this thing is enormous. It's lying upside down, looking a bit like an enormous Labrador.
So while these lions were asleep, one of the guides, Joe Nessel de Volda, gave me a guided tour of one, point by point.
So you've got the whites around the eyes over there. That helps to reflect light up into the eyes for the lions. But their eyes are already so good with rods and cones that it's like having night vision anyway, night vision goggles. And then on the sides of the nose, you see those little cuts over there?
Mm-hmm.
That helps for when they're strangling something or even when they're feeding as well, because the front of the nose will get blocked and then they can't breathe. So those slits at the side of the nose help for them to breathe while they're busy strangling something. Or eating something, actually. And then you go into the fangs. You can see the fangs are nice and sharp and pointy. And you can also judge the age of a lion by the teeth. Sometimes the teeth are very rounded on the older animals, and therefore the older the animal is. And this guy's teeth, he's only 2 years old, so they're nice and sharp at the moment. Then you head back to the carnassials in the back of the mouth, and they are very longish, pointy teeth which act like scissors, and that's when they are chewing through tendons, through the meat, and even through the skin. They slide it into the back of the mouth and they chew, and then that scissor-like action cuts the skin like anything. Then you get to the tongue. The tongue has got very short bristles on it, almost hair-like structures, which actually they use almost like sandpaper to scrape the meat off of the bones. And that's why when you look at a lion kill the next time, the bones that they do lick, it sounds like they're licking them with sandpaper. The meat is literally taken straight off the bones. And you see this boy's coming around now, trying to take his tongue out just now, and he almost bit me.
We can laugh about it now.
Yeah, now. I've still got 10 fingers. Then if you head towards the claws, which are, of course, retractable, very sharp as well, almost like a blunt pointy knife, but quite sharp. And you can imagine the power of this beast coupled with those very sharp talons sliding into the side of an animal and then just gripping. It's the power and the sharpness of those claws just acts like scalpels and cuts through hide like a knife through butter.
This is a 2-year-old animal.
Yes.
The first impression I get of it is it's huge. I mean, it's much bigger than I expected.
They are big for 2-year-old lions, and that's the Kalahari genes in this area as well. In Tualu in particular, we have Kalahari lions, and they're bigger and stronger than other lions because of the harsh environment. And he is a big 2-year-old.
Andy described it as a sense of wonderment. That's a good word.
Yes.
How do you feel? I mean, you see these things on a reasonably regular basis.
Just look at me, I've got goosebumps. I've helped catch lots and lots of lions in my career as a guide, and I still love it, and I still do it every time, every opportunity I can get. We look at these guys, and they look at you, And one of these guys actually followed me back to the vehicle after tracking them on foot the one time. So it's always so nice. You see them from afar in the game drive vehicles, and it's so nice just to get up close and touch these guys.
I think it's a tendency to look at this kind of wildlife farming or wildlife management as a business, and it's possible to be quite cynical about it. But this is not about money. This stockade, 100 metres by 100 metres, has currently got 4 heavily drugged lions in it and about 25 human beings, all of whom are grinning like Cheshire cats and getting their photographs taken with these animals, because when else are you going to get the chance to be in such close proximity to something quite so magnificent?
So Gus is just going to give them the reversal drug, the antidote, and it works very, very quickly. So literally in a couple of minutes, 2-3 minutes, these cats are going to be up and staggering around the boma.
If you just watch her now, you'll see she's gone from shallow breathing, she stops for a bit, and then you see... you see how much bigger the breaths are there. So she's gone from taking short, shallow breaths to these nice, big, deep breaths, and it's almost instantaneous because it's intravenous. So we're going to leave her at that. She'll start picking up her head in a few seconds. Let's move to the next guy.
Now this guy is already partially moving. I don't know about you, but I'm going to leave him to that one.
Yeah, that lion's a lot less asleep than he was. And there goes the reversal drug.
There goes the wake-up drug.
And I think it's time to move swiftly on.
Yeah. Tell you what, let's go around this other way. Cute when it was asleep, not so cute when it's awake.
I suggest we get out of here now because we are pushing our luck.
I've had that feeling for about 15 minutes.
Yeah. They're still nicely stoned, but you don't want them to also get to make an association with us as well.
Uh-huh. Boy, that feels like a relief.
It sure does. My goodness, I wasn't expecting them to see those sort of reactions from those lions.
Yeah,
Gus to say you gave them a mild dose, but... Hey, Gus. You having one of your little practical jokes?
That was, let's not dissemble here at all. That was, when that thing got up and growled, your instinct was to you just turn and run for the hills.
Yeah, you've got to fight that instinct, though, but it's tough. Yeah, it's awesome. I think that rumble is something that's deep-rooted in our genes, I think. We recognise it, even if we've never seen a lion. We'll know what it is.
I think I heard that once before in a cave about 500,000 years before. Well, that's still going.
Yeah.
The whole ethos behind Svalu is conservation. The sheer scale of the operation, the breadth of vision, the resources that are being put into it are extremely impressive. Svalu's owner, Nicky Oppenheimer, has been a regular visitor to Scotland for the last 30 years. He knows Scotland well. So how does he compare the two?
One of the challenging questions I think one faces in conservation is how do you set about conserving? As soon as you have a piece of land with a fence around it, you have to conserve. Nay, you can't let nature run its course because it's not free to do so. And so how do you conserve? And the contrast between how they conserve in Scotland and how you conserve in Svalu, and both doing a fantastic job, is, I think, a challenging one.
Is Scotland doing a fantastic job?
I think so, yeah.
Scotland's doing a fantastic job at maintaining something that was set up in a different era. To my mind, I mean, they have managed to take something which is essentially Victorian and keep it going into the 21st century.
The question you ask is, if they didn't do that, what would happen? And in those parts of Scottish wilderness, if they weren't doing what they were doing, would there be a wilderness? Would there be what animals they are trying to preserve? I think they most probably wouldn't.
Nicky Oppenheimer, owner of Svalu Kalahari Reserve. Of course, that's Nicky's opinion. Other people disagree and say there are lots of things we could do with the land currently being used for sporting purposes. And we're going to take a look at what those things might be in future podcasts. If you've any thoughts on any of this, please email me at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. I'm going to leave you with what was my favourite experience from the whole trip. It didn't involve chasing zebra or darting lions. It was an altogether gentler, quieter thing. I'm Mark Stephen. This has been the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. Thanks for listening.
We're at the Skulpat Dam. Skulpat Dam means the tortoise dam in the Kalahari. We had a waterhole which is frequented by sandgrouse at different times of the day. Right now the sun has set, and in the last light we're seeing double-banded sandgrouse come down, land on the bare patches just to the side, and then slowly walk down to the water's edge, have a drink, douse their breast feathers in water. That way they're picking up some water for their chicks. And they fly off back into the Kalahari drylands to give water to their young and carry on foraging. It's just a few minutes that these birds come down to the water, so our timing is particularly good. What's really interesting is that this species of grouse is here now, but tomorrow morning a different species of grouse will be here fairly early, and then a little later in the day yet another species of sandgrouse will come down to the water. So it just reflects the diversity of the Kalahari. It has three birds that externally are fairly similar, but they're just finding different times of the day to come and drink. Why these birds choose to come and drink at night is anyone's guess. It might be something, there might be something in the way that they avoid predators, or they're scared of aerial predators but the diurnal grouse aren't. I don't know, but it's I always love thinking about the diversity of species in these parts. It is extraordinary.
It's quite an interesting call, a sort of liquid peeping noise. And they're not big birds. I mean, it's kind of hard for me to tell because the sun went down about 20 minutes ago and we're in the gloaming at the moment, half light. Describe them to me.
They're beautifully camouflaged grouse. They're roughly the size of a large pigeon. They've got this lovely call. The males and females are quite different. If you have a look at the males, they have, I suppose it looks something like a nice smart white shirt and a tuxedo across their chest, and the females are more camouflaged.
They kind of scurry around like mice. They're very fast on their feet.
They're fast on their feet. They're running around. I think it's probably maybe to confuse the predators, perhaps, but then they're also incredibly quick on the wing as well. And if one considers the habitat they're living in, they must fly miles and miles and miles to back to their foraging areas. We don't know. We don't follow them that far, but quite extraordinary little guys. Very quick, and just the time they spend at the water, just a couple of gulps of water, dip the feathers, and off they go again.